From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
When I was growing up, I loved to read, and I never, ever saw a black child in a children's book. Not a black child as the main character, a black child, period. No one who looked like me were in the books that I read. And then when my daughter was growing up, she also was a bookworm, mm-hmm. and she came home. She said, you know, I don't see any little black girls in these books. I don't see any black people in these books. And I said, you know, this is just a shame that, you know, here we are, you know, supposedly in this modern age, this, you know, this embracing, you know, age of different people and different types of people, that we're still, my daughter's still facing the same kind of problem. So I decided that I wanted to change that. And the only way you can do that is if you step up and bite the bullet and decide that you're going to, you know, make that change. So it is really important, not just for non-white children to see a reflection of themselves in children's literature, but for all children.
Angela Shelf Medeiros, founder and president of Deeper Productions, Book Boosters, Inc., and an award-winning children's books and cookbook author. After having a successful career as a children's book author, Medeiros' mother and sister urged her to write a cookbook containing their family recipes. Once published, the African American Kitchen Cookbook was a major success. Medeiros has 6 other cooking books, including The Ethnic Vegetarian, The Kitchen Divas Cook, and The Kitchen Divas Diabetic Cookbook. Her career as an author began the day she was fired from a job as a legal secretary. She decided to pursue a dream of writing so that she could be a stay-at-home mom. After 4 long years, hundreds of painful rejection letters, and numerous unpublished manuscripts, Medeiros decided to stop sending her work to New York publishers and submitted her manuscript, Picking Peas for a Penny, to a small regional publisher in her hometown, Austin, Texas. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the kitchen diva, Angela Shelf Medeiros, In Black America.
I became passionate about the history and the technique and the sort of the benefit of cooking, and how people who, when you prepare food for people, how loved they feel, and how food is an instant connection between all races of people, that if you want to do an icebreaker, you know, you talk about food. You know, if I want to break the ice with someone, I feel like, you know, hesitant or uncomfortable or shy or whatever, I say, well, what do you like to eat? What is your favorite food? What is your favorite recipe? What do you remember most about, you know, food from your childhood? People instantly light up when you're talking about food. It's just something about preparing a meal for someone that really makes them feel loved. So that's how I sort of turned my thinking around about food and became passionate about it and made it my life's work to not only learn about the history and culture and cuisines of African and African Americans, but just the history and culture and cuisines of food around the world.
Angela Shelf Medeiros combines a general love for children's literature with a particular attention to the reading needs of young African Americans. According to her, every child needs to find a reflection of him or herself when looking for a book in the library or bookstore. Medeiros' book shows African American life, history, and culture in a positive way, from the celebration of Kwanzaa to a life on a Depression-era farm. She enjoys conveying such historical and cultural subjects in picture book format. Born in Hampton, Virginia, Medeiros received her BA degree from Texas State University. She has written more than 100 award-winning children's books. Her books have sold more than 10 million copies worldwide and are featured on a line of animated DVDs. The Storyteller series, Many Books, Many Languages, bilingual DVDs, are produced and narrated by Medeiros, as well as Angela's Notebook, an educational television program about writing, reading, authors, and illustrators. She has worked as a reading consultant for Scholastic Inc. and McGraw-Hill Literary Programs. Her new series of seminars entitled Eat Your Way Through History began June 19th.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me. I can't think of a better way to spend a Friday afternoon except for on In Black America.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. It's been a while since we last spoke and our audience has heard from you. How did a young lady from Hampton, Virginia end up in Texas?
I'm married to a native Texan. My dad was stationed here when I was in high school. And when I was 18, I met my husband and we got married. And I have lived in Austin, Texas ever since and loved it.
What initially sparked an interest in writing children books?
I got fired from my job as a legal secretary. And I had worked so much overtime and so many weekends that I had enough money to actually live without looking for a job or working for like 3 months. So initially I was upset about being fired because, you know, I had been working really, really hard, but had a difficult boss. But he really did me a favor because that opportunity, those 3 months to really explore what I wanted to do in life was a true blessing. And during that time, my husband got a bunch of part-time jobs and worked really hard so that I could stay home and teach myself how to write and send off different books for submission and learn how to write for newspapers and learn how to write for magazines. So it was a short time as far as learning and a long time, 4 years before I actually got published. So it was difficult, but well worth it. And I thoroughly enjoyed my career as a children's author.
What was the title of that first book, and how long did it take you to write it?
The first book was Picking Peas for a Penny, and it was the story about my mother growing up during the Depression and picking peas on a farm in Oklahoma, and then getting 5 cents for, you know, fields and fields of peas, and then going to the general store and spending that money. So it didn't take long to write because she had been telling us those stories my entire childhood. What was difficult was getting it published. I had 32 rejection letters. I was pretty much down in the dumps about ever getting a children's book published when I saw this little sign on a building in a strip center in Austin that was next to a sandwich shop and, you know, a few other different little stores and shops. And I thought I would go in there to see if they would publish my book because I knew they were a book publisher, but I didn't know what kind of books. So when I went in there, they told me that they did the works of deceased famous Texas writers, and they weren't really in the market for a children's book. But the owner had picked peas as a child, grew up during the Depression, had a similar story to my mother. And so he said that he would give me a shot. So they did 500 paperbacks, 500 hardbacks, handed me the boxes and said, okay, well, we're all done here. You know, we've done you this favor by putting your work into print. It's up to you what you do with them from here on out. So my husband started the part of his life he calls Driving Miss Angela, mm-hmm. where we drove from town to town and school to school. And this was before internet was really popular, so I could call a school and just tell them that, you know, I was a new author and wanted to come. And you know, for $25, I would come to your school and put on a 45-minute presentation about writing and storytelling. And, of course, you know, the schools wanted something like that. But the reason why I would show up right before I was supposed to present was because as an African-American author, I wasn't as accepted as authors of other races. So, and because my name, Medeiros, doesn't really sound, you can't really determine what nationality I might be, I would just sort of show up at the last minute when the kids were already sitting on that, you know, hard gym floor and everybody was already there and waiting on me. I would just show up and then, you know, they would be forced pretty much to present me because couldn't cancel it then. But one thing I always remember is when I'd walk into the gym, the kids would say, "She's black." And I'd say, "Yes, I am." You know, and then do, you know, a fantastic presentation. And so word of mouth spread. We sold, you know, 10,000 books that way until the point where the publisher said, you know, we are not equipped to do anything like this. You know, we're getting phone calls. All our authors are dead. We have to, you know, we've never set up book signings or anything because we've never had, you know, it's always been quiet and peaceful around here. And now the phone's ringing off the wall. So you need to find a bigger publisher. So that started me off on my career. And I've been published by every major New York publishing house from Simon & Schuster to, you know, Harcourt, and won a lot of awards along the way. So for 25 years, that was my life.
Why is it important to have African-American as main characters in children's books?
To me, when I was growing up, I loved to read, and I never, ever saw a Black child in a children's book. Not a Black child as the main character, a Black child, period. No one who looked like me were in the books that I read. And then when my daughter was growing up, she also was a bookworm, mm-hmm. and she came home and she said, I don't see any little Black girls in these books. I don't see any Black people in these books. And I said, you know, this is just a shame that, you know, here we are, you know, supposedly in this modern age, this, you know, this embracing, you know, age of different people and different types of people, that we're still, my daughter's still facing the same kind of problem. Mm-hmm. So I decided that I wanted to change that. And the only way you can do that is if you step up and bite the bullet and decide that you're going to, you know, make that change. So it is really important, not just for non-white children to see a reflection of themselves in children's literature, but for all children to see that, because if you don't see that, you don't realize that there are different kinds of cultures, there are different kinds of people. And so when you grow up and get out into the workforce, which is going to be diverse, and get out into the world, which is going to be diverse, you're not accustomed to that. It's some kind of strange thing to you. So it's important to start children out early with that diversity, with that understanding, with that ability to see a reflection of themselves and their families and their culture and their holidays in literature and in the media.
Do you incorporate other characters of other races or ethnicities in your stories?
I write about all kinds of children, all flavors and kinds and colors, mm-hmm. and shapes and sizes, because that has always been my world. I've always been around children of all different kinds of races and colors and shapes and sizes and beliefs. And so my work is a reflection of my world. And I think, you know, a lot of times I get asked that question, do you ever have white children in your books? And I'm like, yes. I said, but the sad thing is that I've been to a lot of authors' conferences, and white authors have never asked if they have Black children in their books. But Black authors seem to be required to have white children in their books, but it's not a dual sort of thing. We're asked if we reflect white characters, but white authors aren't asked if they reflect children of other races. You know, that's not been my experience anyway. So, you know, I would like to get to a point where it's just understood that, mm-hmm. if you're going to write about, you know, real life, that real life will be a reflection of real people.
You talked about when you enter the classroom, the children are surprised that you're African American. But once they get past that astonishment, how has the receptions been?
Oh, I have had the best experiences with those children. And really, the fact that children are so embracing of something they enjoy, mm-hmm. and that the fact that they like you and like your work, unlike adults, you know, they can begrudgingly acknowledge that you're really good and that this is a good story and that you are talented. They can begrudgingly do that, but they won't get past it to a point where they'll support you. Children, mm-hmm. once you send them over like that, they are on your side. And so I'm still getting the kids that I started off with when we were doing the Driving Miss Angela days, they're parents now. And they send me emails and tell me about the books that they loved and how they're reading them to their children. And when they start saying, I'm reading them to my grandchildren, I'm going to go lay down somewhere. But right now, they're just saying, I'm reading them to my children. Because you can make an impression on them so that they understand your world and, mm-hmm. your life through your stories. And so I've even had kids that wanted a book so bad that they called their parents and told their parents they had to come to the school right now with $5. That's how much the book used to cost, mm-hmm. because I was only going to be there for that day. And so what parent wouldn't take off their job and come bring some money to buy a book, you know, for their child? You know, what child would be so moved that you had to have a book? So I really attribute my success to the support that children have given me over the years, and the love that they've had for the stories, and the way that they have connected to the stories that take it beyond race.
I know that's right. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Henson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with the kitchen diva, Angela Shelf Medeiros, founder and president of Book Boosters, Inc. award-winning children's book author and cookbook author. Ms. Medeiros, what led you to begin writing cookbooks?
Well, I have been married now for 42 years to the same wonderful man, Michael Medeiros.
Congratulations.
And thank you. And throughout our years together, I was never much of a cook. And so I never had really any interest in it. But about 15 years ago, I was on my way to an author's visit. He was dropping me off at the airport, and I leaned over to kiss him goodbye, and I looked in his eyes, and they were yellow. And I said, Michael, my goodness, you know, what is going on with you? I said, go right to the doctor. I said, don't go to work. Just go right to the doctor. So he went to the doctor. By the time I landed, he had gotten the diagnosis, which was that his glucose levels were like 400, which is close to, you know, could be very well stroke level. You could go into a diabetic coma with those kind of numbers.
Okay.
So I knew I had to change the way I cooked. I knew I had to change the way that we lived our lifestyle and the way that you know, that I did everything pretty much. So I started checking out books supposed to be for people with diabetes, and they were really depressing. They were black and white. There were no pictures at all. And it was probably just as well, because I could tell from the recipe that it was not going to be something tasty and appealing. So I got interested in creating a cookbook that would be not only for a person with diabetes, but people who were in the family that did not have diabetes. Because it's really difficult to cook one meal for a person with diabetes and then a whole separate meal for a person who doesn't have diabetes. So I just created recipes that were delicious for people who have diabetes and just healthy and delicious for people who didn't. So that's my seventh cookbook, which is the Kitchen Divas Diabetic Cookbook. But initially, I even got started, writing cookbooks because my mother wanted to find a way to supplement her income, and also my sisters wanted to preserve her recipes. So my first book was The African American Kitchen, but that was just me as a writer, not me as a cook. My mom and my sister tested all the recipes. I constructed it, did the proposal, did the format of it, which was tracing the contributions of Africans and African-Americans to the cuisines of the world, starting in Africa, going to the Caribbean, going to the Americas, both North and South, and then coming up to modern-day kitchens. So I thought that after I did that cookbook for my mom, that my work, you know, was done. But I didn't know that they would send you out on cookbook tours and that you had to cook in 7 minutes in front of a live audience and talk and explain and, you know, and dice and slice. And, you know, I had no idea, because my world was children's books. I wasn't into the cookbook thing. So my sister, Marcia, who is a really excellent cook, went along with me on these tours. And I did all the talking and she did all the cooking and no one noticed. So I could kind of fake it until she and two things. One, I discovered I love television, and she discovered she hated it.
Mm-hmm.
So we were the kitchen divas, and we did that for a while until she finally just said, I'm almost having panic attacks thinking about going on camera. It's just too stressful. I don't like it. I don't want to do it anymore. So that kind of forced me into really getting down to business to learn how to cook. And so I became passionate about the history and the technique and the sort of the benefit of cooking, and how people who, when you prepare food for people, how loved they feel, and how food is an instant connection between all races of people, that if you want to do an icebreaker, you know, you talk about food. You know, if I want to break the ice with someone, I feel like, you know, hesitant or uncomfortable or shy or whatever, I say, well, what do you like to eat? What is your favorite food? What is your favorite recipe? What do you remember most about, you know, food from your childhood? People instantly light up when you're talking about food. It's just something about preparing a meal for someone that really makes them feel loved. So that's how I sort of turned my thinking around about food and became passionate about it and made it my life's work to not only learn about the history and culture and cuisines of African and African Americans, but just the history and culture and cuisines of food around the world and the importance of a diet when it comes to combating diabetes.
I remember you telling me a story when you were first submitting your cookbooks to a publisher, and mm-hmm. you send along a pie to one
I
of the
cobblers.
Cobblers too. To if nothing else, they would have to open the package.
I couldn't get him to read the book. You know, my mama wanted this book published. You know how it is when your mama wants something, and they kept rejecting the cookbook. You know, and I don't know if they'd heard that I couldn't cook. I don't know what the deal was, but that I couldn't get the publisher to read the cookbook. Now the editor had read the cookbook and she loved it. You know, but I couldn't get the guy who signs the check, which is the publisher of Dutton, to actually read the cookbook. Yeah. So that's why I came up with the idea. The only thing I can really make well are pies, because that's my mother's favorite thing to make. So I figured if I sent him a peach cobbler and let him know that a peach cobbler was coming, that if nothing else, while he was eating the peach cobbler, he might thumb through the cookbook finally. And that's exactly what happened. He got the peach cobbler, he got the manuscript, and by 2 o'clock that afternoon, when it arrived in New York, I had a contract for my first cookbook. And so my mother was happy. And like I said, I thought my work was done, but it was just getting started.
I also remember the story that touched on it when you had to actually appear on television. There was mm-hmm. actually two sessions. You have to cook the meal prior to broadcast, and then you have to redo what you've done already?
For a lot of the cookbook tours that you do where you appear on national television shows, they have a person there that'll assist you with preparation of the finished dish. You're getting there the day before, and you don't have a kitchen, so they usually help you with that. Now, the bulk of the tour is at local broadcast stations, which might have a microwave, a refrigerator, and a sink if you're lucky. A microwave, a refrigerator, and a sink if you're really fortunate. So I would have to go in there and bring my own electric skillet, my own knives, my own spoons. I had to bring everything in a suitcase equipped to do a cooking demo. And that's how I traveled for a long time. And so a lot of times we were moving so quick that I'd have to wrap the electric skillet up in like a blanket or something because it was still hot and then go to the next and then go to the next appearance. And that's just what you did. It's really difficult when you're trying to do those cooking demos on television. It's difficult because you have to have everything perfect and you only have 7 minutes and you cannot mess up because it's live. So it was a good training ground for a person like me that kind of got thrown into this whole world of the whole culinary world. But I can see why my sister just really hated it.
Did you have one of those celebrity chefs at your house?
Celebrity chefs at my house?
I think it was.
What do you mean?
It was a cooking. It was a cooking show, and you had a cook off with one of those celebrity chefs. I'm just making this up.
No. One of the funny things that happened to me was that Food Network had a show called Throwdown with Bobby Flay.
Right.
And they asked me to submit a historic or favorite recipe, which I did. And I thought, oh, this is nice. You know, and they said that they want to do a biographical profile about me and my work. And I said, oh, this is great. So I sent them a recipe for jerk chicken and the culinary history behind jerk chicken, which was created by the Maroons, which were a group of slaves in the Caribbean that had run away into the mountains. And they used this jerk chicken because they could take a stick and poke holes in chicken and then stuff it full of spices and it would preserve it until they could get to a place where they could cook it. So they came down for 3 days and they filmed me doing a radio show. They filmed me doing a children's book presentation. They filmed me everywhere. They filmed me in my house. They filmed me cooking. They filmed my family. They filmed and filmed and filmed. And on the last day, they said, well, we want you to invite all your friends and family, and we want you to prepare the jerk chicken for your friends and family. And that's going to be the finale of this biographical profile. So I was cooking, getting ready to serve, when all of a sudden, Iron Chef Bobby Flay, who is a well-known chef in New York and around the world, and also has Iron Chef status, which is the top of the top as far as being a chef, mm-hmm. he rolls up, and this is a show called Throwdown with Bobby Flay, where he challenges you to, where he prepares your recipe, and you prepare your recipe, and a panel of judges decide who does it the best. So, you know, it was on then. I'm first I was, you know, stunned. And then it was just on, you know, like you're going to come down here and challenge me with my own recipe? I think not. So I have this little, we have a store here in Texas called HEB, and I had a grill that I had bought on sale at HEB. So you could imagine if it was on sale in the wintertime that it was probably, it wasn't in the best condition. But, and he had these huge, expensive, well-known $1,000 grills, and the entire, you know, prep crew from the Food Network, and a truck full of equipment and all this fancy stuff. And I mean, he backed up and it was unbelievable. So, you know, I just did what I do. You know, I talked a lot of smack and pretended like, you know, that I wasn't nervous at all. And when the judging panel decided that they loved my dish the best, that really was a launch pad for my career on television. So I was able to create the Kitchen Diva show after that for PBS. And I'm hoping to get the show back on the air again with a new version, sort of based on healthier takes on American comfort foods. But, you know, money's always an issue with PBS. That Celebrity Chef episode on PBS really brought me a lot of attention and opened up a lot of opportunities.
That leads me to, you got an event coming up, Eat Your Way Through History. Tell us about that.
Well, I love doing these kind of culinary history events, and I wanted to do this event, particularly at the George Washington Carver Museum in Austin, Texas, because it's such a fabulous museum. And I'm using this Eat Your Way Through History as a draw for people to come and visit the museum and also eat some of the foods that George Washington Carver is famous for, as far as using them as a way to correct the problems with the soil in the South. So what Dr. Carver would do is he would plant things like what they call cowpeas, which are also known as black-eyed peas, sweet potatoes, nutrient-rich vegetables, tomatoes, just all kinds of different plants so that the soil in the South would have a rest from being depleted from the cotton plants. And he pretty much almost single-handedly saved the economy in the South, because had he not come up with a way to enrich the soil, there would be no Southern economy the way that we know it is today. And so he had to have a way for people to not only plant these plants to enrich the soil, but also to use the food that was a result of planting them.
Angela Shelf Medeiros, founder and president of Deeper Productions, Book Boosters, and an award-winning children's books and cookbook author. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David S. Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.